This episode of Cooking Issues is brought to you by Bob's Red Mill, an employee-owned company that has been offering organic stone ground products for decades.
With Bob's Red Mill, you're not just getting quality, you're getting flavor-packed healthy food that tastes great.
Visit bobsredmill.com to learn more and use the code COOKINGISSUES, that's one word, all caps, COOKING ISSUES, for 25% off your order. Cooking Issues, this is Dave Arnold, your host of Cooking Issues, coming to you live on the Heritage Radio Network every Tuesday from roughly 12 to roughly 12:45 from Roberta's Pizzeria in Bushwick, Brooklyn. Nothing on the, Dave's not giving me anything today. That's fine. I like it. That's fine.
I don't always.
Okay. We got Dave in the booth. How you doing, Dave?
Thank you, everybody.
How you doing, Dave?
I'm good. How about you?
All right. You have a good week?
Yeah. Yeah. Weekend?
By the way, next week, no show. I'm in China. I'm in China again.
We're on break, too, so that's convenient.
Oh, nice. Working on the next Booker and Dax product, which I cannot tell you about because I cannot possibly kill all three people that are listening to this.
We would stop you.
Yeah, well, they'd have to go find him. Got Nastasia the Hammer Lopez. How you doing, Stas?
Good.
How's your week been?
Fine.
Good.
Tell us about your flight.
In a minute. I feel we should actually have a lot of things to talk about today. So...
No.
For those of you that don't know, LaGuardia Airport is a nice airport to fly into, even though it's horrific and cramped and terrible, because once you get in, you are close to being back into Manhattan. You're not, like, in the middle of nowhere. Problem is, as I've said many times, if someone even spits at the runway in LaGuardia, they shut that thing down. So, like, I'm flying back from Chicago yesterday, and I was doing something for Heaven Hill Distilleries. I'm in Chicago. And I'm like, I'm going to get on the 6 a.m. because I knew it was raining. I'm going to get on the 6 a.m. flight. The 6 a.m. flight! Because I know that if they let one plane in, they're going to let the 6 a.m. plane in. So we take off, and then we get over, and all of a sudden, like around like 8, right before we're about to land, a thunderstorm moves in over New York, right? And so what do these chumps do? They circle LaGuardia. And by the way, air traffic controllers, if I have anyone out there as an air traffic controller, you are a sadistic lot. You are a sadistic son of a guns out there. Have a circling in the cloud in the rainstorm, just like like waiting, because again, like if you remember Mike Pence, like, you know, the airplane like looks at the runway sideways and it skids off into the water, right? So we're sitting there like an hour, like going around getting some. Of course, they're not saying squat. Then they're like, "Hey, well, they wouldn't let us divert to JFK. They wouldn't let us divert to Newark." So we're going to Philadelphia. Goodbye. And so we like fly low through the clouds to Philadelphia.
Because you were losing gas.
We're out of gas. Literally, as we land.
It's becoming a Die Hard 2 situation.
As we land, my wife, by the way, I hate flying. As we land, my wife texts me. She's like, good news. It's starting to clear up in New York. I'm like, oh! So we have to sit on the ground and wait to refuel. And then we get delayed even more, obviously, because they had shut LGA. So they had to reopen it later, and then we had to get a new slot. So I thought I was going to get a whole work day done on the bar yesterday, and instead I spent it in the fabulous travels.
Did you have to change planes, too?
We had to get off because they no longer knew who was on the airplane, because they let some people off but didn't take down their information.
Oh,
so everyone had to leave the plane.
It sounds like standard TSA operating procedure, yeah.
Yeah, you all have to leave the plane and then come back right back on. We're like, what? They're like, yeah, trust me. Yeah, so we, anyway.
Dave, I also hate flying, and I got my doctor to prescribe me lorazepam.
What is that?
It's like, I think it's similar to, like, Xanax.
Yeah, I used to take that stuff, and then I somehow got myself off of it. What I'm thinking of doing is just, because I'm flying to China on Monday, and the worst is, like, if it's a one-hour flight, although it can turn into a three-hour flight if you're, you know, by mistake. But if it's like a 1 hour flight, you're like, or 2 hour flight, you're like, hey, I'm gonna take it for the whole time because whatever, like, how bad can it be? I can just sit there and have that awful fear sweat for like a couple of hours, and I know it's gonna be over one way or the other.
But
I'm
gonna
hit the ground or not,
because it's a smaller plane probably if it's only an hour or 2 hour flight.
Yeah, but when you're flying to China and you have conceivably another 14 hours, right? Your mind is like, this could last 14 hours. You know what I mean? And also, you know, if you're in the middle of the damn plane and you have no windows, Nastasia, you hate being in the middle of the plane with no windows because even just being able to see outside, you're like, okay, I can see at least that we're on fire and we're going down. At least I know. You know what I mean? When you're sealed in that tube, it's like, Anyway, we have on the show today, special guest.
Nice segue.
Yes, special guest. Talking about his new book. We have, well, it's not new-ish, new-ish. Was newer when you were supposed to come on originally. Yeah. James Brichion. I'm told that that's the way that he likes to pronounce it, although it could be pronounced any one of eight different ways. His new book, Flavor Matrix, and you're also at the Institute for Culinary Education. What's your title over there?
Director of Culinary Research.
Director of Culinary Research.
Mic in his direction. There you go.
So how you doing, James?
Excellent.
All right, so call in all of your Flavor Matrix flavor pairing questions to James at 718-497-2128. That's 718-497-2128. And why don't you tell us a little bit about, why don't you give people like the 30-second pitch on the book here?
So been studying the science of flavor for a really long time. The whole project began back at ICE when we were working with IBM on the Chef Watson project, and we started to get into flavor pairing theory.
Tell them what Watson is in case they don't know.
So if anyone missed Chef Watson, it is, we worked with IBM, their Watson computing system, to study chemical compounds in foods and find matches between ingredients based on the chemical compounds that create flavor in food. So kind of a new way to look at putting ingredients together.
Let me ask you a question. Why'd they give it a dude's name?
Seriously. I was told, actually, that Watson was a woman.
Then, like, I'm sorry. There are some gender-neutral names.
Last name,
they could have gone Pat. They could have gone Pat.
It's Pat.
And then, like, what is Pat? I don't know. I mean, that would have been amazing, right? And then they could have glued that Pat face on it. The voices that Watson uses when he's being a prick to those people in the airplane hangar is a dude's voice.
Yeah.
It's very 2001 Space Odyssey kind of a thing.
Same on Jeopardy.
Yeah, and when he's talking crap about the coffee maker and that other thing, he's using a dude's voice and making like I think he was a little saucy with the coffee maker, and that's why she's not talking to him. But my point is, why a dude? That seems like, you know, they should work on that. Next time you're with them, they should just, you know, I know it's actually just a computer and not a human being, so they could just, you know, rename it or come out. The next gen should definitely be a woman. I think.
I never spoke. Like, it was, we walked in and opened up a laptop and you're like, okay, there's Watson. There was no fancy UI. There was no conversations with Watson. It was a laptop.
IBM, if you're out there, next gen woman. Or at least gender neutral. I'm okay with gender neutral.
Taylor.
Although to everyone now, Taylor's Taylor Swift, right?
Is it? I don't know. I'm just
about
billions. Yeah, exactly.
Oh, I never seen the show.
It's a good show.
I have a really good story about the show that I'm not allowed to tell you. Did we tell that on air? I don't think we told that
What
on
is
air.
It?
Mine?
Well, I can't tell you.
What's the story?
I love the started with I'm not allowed to tell you, and then he's launching straight into it from there.
I let's put it this way.
He's so conflicted. He really wants to tell it.
It got part of the... No, I won't say anything about it, but like one of the episodes had like a Me Too moment where they had to get like a Christopher Plummer-style reshoot on it. And because they had to remove one of the characters and add somebody else in. And I really think that what they should do, first of all, I think in a show about like billionaires, they should just admit, if you're watching a show about people who are rancid, power, you know, hungry, like billionaires, why should you get pissed off when the people who are actually in it are rough too? I mean, that's what you kind of want out of it, no? But they did the reshoot. I think in general they should just not reshoot and just take Christopher Plummer's face and then no matter who it is, just paste his face over it as like a thing. What do you think? Yeah, Christopher Plummer. All right. So 30-second pitch on the book. Wait, we're back to Watson. Sorry. Yeah. So Watson is an AI program that takes big data, crunches it, and then makes predictions, in your case, about food, but it could be about whether or not you need to replace an engine or how much water you need to add to your crops in XYZ field or yada.
Yada and yada. So that got me kind of into this subject, but the book was written without any use of Watson. We spent all of our time in the volatile compounds in food database, the VCF database that lists every aromatic compound in the majority of ingredients on Earth, and those are all of the chemicals that are responsible for flavor in food.
Now, who owns that?
It's a paid subscription database.
Yeah, how much does that cost? Like lots.
Yeah. You know, we got into it. I mean, you know how much money there is in book writing, right?
Oh, so much, dude. Yeah.
So spent about 2 years in the VCF creating spreadsheets, finding the matches. They do actually have a nice little compare and search tool. And we basically adapted the, you know, the wine or beer or coffee flavor wheel, like tasting wheel, and adapted it to food. And then we created data points for every aroma in 58 of the most common ingredients, or 58 ingredient categories, which cover about 110 total ingredients. And then we also listed out, for the people who really want to dig into the science and get nerdy, the top three aroma compounds in each ingredient, the flavors they present. So it's hopefully for, you know, people who start digging into it, it's a new way to think about flavor and combining ingredients.
And so just so people who haven't seen the book, the format is an introduction of, like, you know, how you got into this stuff, and then just here are these ingredients, the wheels for those ingredients, and then a recipe that has the main ingredient and then with other adjuncts that are pulled off of the wheel, and then at the end kind of a little more here, you know, a little more in depth on some of the actual things, right? So it's like just what you need to know to figure out why I'm doing this, the stuff, and then some more explanation at the end. That's the basic layout, right?
Yeah, exactly. So if you want to just hit it up for some ideas about, hey, I got a boatload of zucchini in my CSA and I want to do something different with zucchini, I want to start changing up some recipes, flip up into the zucchini pairing wheel. You'll see which flavors pair best with zucchini and start picking out ingredients.
Zucchini pairs best with the garbage can.
You don't like zucchini?
Zucchini is a garbage product. Here's the thing. Zucchini is good. Here's what zucchini is good for. If you core it and therefore take out all of that, like, moisture-inducing nonsense and stuff it with meat, that tastes good. If you take zucchini and you press the hell out of it so it doesn't turn into a greasy, sopping mess of nightmare, and then somehow quickly cook it, fine. It's not even a good vehicle for dip because it's too freaking spongy. You'd always, always rather have a cucumber than a freaking zucchini stick in a dip situation, 100% of the time.
What? Yeah, why would it ever be in a dip situation?
People do it. People do it, right? And then, like, the reason zucchinis exist as a product at all is zucchini bread is delicious, where it's really just... it's just a filler.
It's fiber. Just fiber. I mean, it is, from a flavor perspective, it's extraordinarily low on the list.
And the other reason it exists is squash blossoms.
Oh, yes.
Because Florida calabaza, let's face it, is awesome.
Absolutely.
And for those of you that don't know, and I'm sure that's a lot of people, is that if you just take... so the group of things that includes pumpkin, squash, cucumber, zucchini is the cucurbits, right? And they all have these kind of big, showy, papery flowers that look like squash blossoms, but they have very different tastes. So, like, some, like pumpkin blossoms, for instance, I thought, well, I could use these as squash blossoms, because you want to get rid of a lot of the extra blossoms because you don't want, you know, you don't want too many pumpkins on your vine. Anyways, they taste terrible. Like, you need to get, like, good ones. Like, the varietal is important. Nastasia is a cognoscenti of squash blossoms.
Wow.
Yeah, it's a true story. It is a true story. So anyway, go ahead, zucchini. You were saying?
Just as an example of something you're going to have a boatload of in your CSA because
it's garbage.
Grows like crazy. And, yeah. Right, exactly. But so you can just flip open, you can look at the graphic and go, oh, here are the best things that go with zucchini. Or if you want to really dig into them, like, I got to figure out a way to use this, you can go back, look up the compounds that create the little bit of flavor there is actually in zucchini. And then, you know, start attacking it that way to try to find the best matches or try to get creative with it. Book's been out for just over a month now. I'm hearing from a ton of mixologists, people who are really kind of, you know, digging in and using it to get creative with cocktails, which has been really cool.
Yes, we're the worst group of people in the world. No, I'm kidding. I love people who sling drinks. Anyway, so obviously we're opening a new bar. By the way, I can now say it didn't come out, but people have leaked it. Oh. If you want to know what we're doing, it was leaked for some reason to Punch, so you can look it up. Anyways,
you want to take a call?
Well, one second. So we'll take a call. We'll take a call. But I have a couple of minor bones. Not bones to pick, but we're gonna hash some stuff out, you and I, James. And then okay. After that, we have a more general hash out that I think is going to be kind of like fun for our crew. But caller, we'll take the caller first. Caller, you're on the air.
Yeah, hello. This is Quinn, actually, calling in again.
Hey, how you doing? From Vancouver Island.
Yeah. I'm doing good. I came up with a question because I actually had a quick answer to a previous week's question I thought I'd call in. So what would you like first, the question or the answer?
I will take question first and then answer.
Okay, so my question was, I think I'm going to definitely get this book, but I'm curious, has there been any official study sort of analyzing the complexity of different ingredient groups? Like, obviously, there's the big compound, but I would love to settle a bet between me and my brother, which is more complex, wine or tea?
Oh, this is an excellent question, and I'm going to let James go, and then I'm going to argue with him. Go.
So there is a lot, and I mean, complexity, you can kind of look at that a couple different ways, but I mean, the simplest way would just be to quantify the number of different aromatic compounds that make up each ingredient. That's in the VCF, that's exactly what you're going to get. You get a full list of the compounds that have been identified through most of this data in the VCF comes from academic papers. So it's, you know, there's been a gas chromatography, you know, study done on kind of general tea or general wine. There's not a lot on wine because it changes year to year to year. So it's really hard to kind of collect that data and keep it analyzed.
A lot of proprietary people have that, like in-house, like everyone has their own.
I mean, and you can get some kind of generals on variety. Like we did a thing for Food and Wine Magazine on their wine issue about building recipes based off of compounds in specific wines, and you can get sort of the generals of the varietals.
Like what the cat pee aroma is, et cetera, et cetera.
Right,
yeah.
Exactly. I would have to check the numbers. I don't know off the top of my head. I believe that tea is higher than wine in the number of compounds.
All right, here's where I think this is problematic, right? Everyone wants to say that whatever product they're hawking at the time is the most complicated, or like it goes back to the, we, you know, like the people who say we have the most vitamin C, we have the most number of compounds, the most polyphenols, we have the most, you know. And the thing is that at the end of the day, complexity doesn't boil down to how many different compounds are in something, because to be honest, a lot of things can be there in minute quantities that don't have a huge flavor impact. And also, you know, most compounds have on the order of less than 10 things in them that provide the majority of the aroma impact, the volatile impact that something is going to have. So, you know, to me, I think rather than looking at the chemical signature of something to see how complicated it is, look at how people have treated it over the years. So, like, people tend to focus on simple ingredients with wide ranges of flavor, things like tea, where, you know, one ingredient, two with water, you know,
coffee,
wine. Why? Because they are complicated, right? And they repay study. And so, like, actual complexity in terms of what your mind and tongue see has as much to do with the scholarship behind it and how much people pay attention to it. 50 years ago, there was not nearly the vocabulary on coffee, even among professionals, that there is now. And the reason is that kind of the human beings hadn't built up the kind of scholarship. So we sense complexity in coffee that the average, even professional, I think, wouldn't have sensed 50 years ago. And it's because we've developed a language to be able to do it. So complexity is somewhat in the eye of the taster, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, you go to a professional, you know, or taste wine with a professional, you take a sip, and then you might sense certain things, and then they tell you, oh, hey, you know, cucumber, blackberry, these things, you know, black pepper, these things are here. And then you take another sip, and you're like, oh, yeah, okay, now, you know, once you're aware to start searching for these, you know, particular aromas or flavors in something, and then they absolutely become, you know, easier to find.
Yeah, and I think what's really interesting, what is fun, is when you, not you, but one, as a kind of a lay taster, like tastes something, and then you later read something that backs you up, that is kind of nice. You know what I mean? When you're like, yes, there is this compound, you're like, I knew I was right. I knew it. All right, so what's your answer, Quinn?
Oh, well, I remember a few weeks ago, someone called in about making a fruit-based katsuobushi.
Yes.
And I was thinking, I think a good way to do that, since it seems like they were skewing more toward a sweet application or cocktail,
right?
Instead of doing a protein-based gel, what if you combined
starchy,
like apple pie, apple,
right?
And then maybe reinforce with a little rice flour, and then even stick all of that into like even a synthetic sausage casing so it doesn't just fall apart, and then ferment that.
Nastasia has referred to me as a synthetic sausage casing on many occasions. Yeah, no, try it. I mean, like,
Ayo.
Also, family show. Also, I will say that someone else mentioned, which I have also noticed, is that people inoculate dried fruits, not hyper-dried fruits, but like par-dried or semi-dried fruits, specifically things like Japanese persimmon or Korean persimmon, inoculate them with mold, and they do, when you once you trim off the mold, have a different flavor. And I've actually noticed this by accident because I let some persimmons go moldy, and I was like, I'm not going to waste them. So I trimmed them off and had them. So I think if we could maybe try that, Quinn, or I think some of these mold inoculations on larger format dried fruits, not like thinner ones, but larger format dried fruits like blended persimmons or whatnot to inoculate them with mold, you can get some. You know, my reaction to the caller was, as you said, like, I think he wanted more. What? You cut out for a sec. I think he wanted more sweet stuff. And so, like, on the savory side, that stuff's all about protein breakdown products. It's 100% about protein breakdown products. But not on the sweet side. Yep.
When it breaks down starches, it does create sugars, like in the case of mirin.
Right, but... like mirin also has a savory hit to it. I don't actually know where it comes from, but mirin has a savory hit to it. But when I think katsuobushi, I'm thinking 100% like protein breakdown, right? When I think of whenever I'm tasting something old-ish, I'm always tasting for it's all breakdown product situation. So when you taste a cheese, right? Like certain cheeses, I can taste and know they're full fat because, like fat breakdown, like lipid oxidation products make my tongue like explode. Have you ever had your taste bud like pop out? It looks like a little mushroom cloud on the tip of your tongue. Has ever happened to you, Nastasia? Mm-hmm. It's painful. Happened to you, James?
No.
Yeah. Anyway, so like full fat aged cheeses, like I love them. I eat them, but like they cause this immense pain on my tongue because my taste buds will like pop. I'm like semi. Sensitive to them.
Blowing your taste buds.
Blowing me, like literally blowing them out. Blow them out! But like, point being that like, wow. You're looking for breakdown products. And when I think katsuobushi, the main breakdown products that we're getting from them are protein products. Now, breakdown of sugar things. Typically, sugar breakdown products are, let's face it, simple in flavor. Unless they then go through low temp, long age Maillard, which they do. You know, and you get like, you know, non-enzymatic browning. Which is, you know, long-term Maillard reactions, and they can be somewhat complex, but not on that savory umami hit like you get out of protein breakdown products. Because, I mean, look, all the main savory fermented stuff that we eat, soy, fish sauce, miso, you pick one.
Parmesan cheese.
You know, any one of these things, Worcestershire sauce, whatever, you know what I mean? Protein breakdown. It's all protein breakdown.
And you know, the other issue with the fruit is it's your water content is so, I mean, there's not going to be much. Like persimmon was my first thought on it too, but it's water.
But once they bled it out, it turns meaty because it's big enough. But right. Very few fruits do that.
Have that. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, like, I've had some dry melons that are interesting.
That was second thought there, you know, was potentially in some dry melons, and you've already got like a little bit of that natural funk, you know, especially in cantaloupe, you've got that stinky. Yeah. So, you know, there might be something there as well. But I think again, like even with a cantaloupe, you know, your water content is just so high that you're not going to have much left.
Right. You need to do a par dehy first. Dehy is French for dehydration, but it's not really. Yeah, you got to get rid of some of that water first, because otherwise it just goes straight to spoil town instead of...
If you want umami, I mean, we need some amino acids from somewhere.
You need it. There's no other way. Literally, your taste buds are there so that you are like, oh, I am receiving protein. You know what I mean? And that's part of the bone I have to pick with you.
All right, here we go.
You put savory down. First of all, okay, you have this... It is 100% true. People confuse what happens in their nose. When I say nose, I mean the whole megilla, all your olfactory senses, right? On the tongue, and then the various trigeminal senses that you have, right? And so the main break is between flavor and taste, right?
Right.
So taste is, you know, t- taste is Nastassia's bad taste in watching The Bachelor constantly. No. It's like, with stuff that happens on your tongue, it's like, yeah, yeah, terrible. She loves that stuff. Nastassia.
You watched it once and you were sucked in a little bit.
No, I could see that.
That's a lie.
I could see you getting into it.
Does the winner get the rose or the loser get the rose?
Winner.
Does it matter?
Well,
it's all about the journey.
It matters to the...
As long as you're there for the right reasons.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. The right reasons are what? Nastassia, like...
I don't like it.
Oh, I don't like it. I just watch it. I'm not one of those people. I just, you know, Jerry Springer is just on for the milieu that it creates in my apartment. You know what I mean? It's like, anyway. So, where were we? We were talking about... flavor and taste. So like to me here's where I think we're a little bit different, or where I don't know. You tell me where we are. So to me, taste is the crap that's on your tongue.
Right. Six senses, basically.
Well, we can argue about that. You know, what about CO2? CO2 is mediated by that. I mean,
I think there's, yeah. So, that's not a taste bud reaction. That's a nerve reaction.
No.
Because, like, it's
enzyme mediated through your sour receptor. So, I think it's, at least that's what Zucker said. I mean, maybe they've done more research, but I'm saying it's complicated. I think, like,
I think we're going to see the number of recognized tastes double in the next 10 to 15 years.
Right. So let's not even say how many tastes there are. Let's not get into whether or not, like, how fat works. Let's not even get into that. Let's just divide this crap into crap that's on your tongue.
and crap that's in your nose.
Crap that's in your nose. And crap that's just an irritant, like trigeminal. Or crap that's mainly a sensation of, like you know, I see that you believe, and I don't really know what's current, so I don't have a belief on, like, how astringency works. Whether it's just, you know, an actual, like, tactile sensation or what. Let's not even go there. Right? Crap that's on your tongue, or crap that's in your nose. So most of the time what you seem to go is you seem to take the flavor is the crap in your nose,
right,
and taste is the crap in your tongue, and ooh, crap on your tongue. Nasty. But then, like, I've always thought, my view has always been, taste is the crap on your tongue, flavor is the combination of olfaction and the crap on your tongue. Like, it's the whole Megilla. But you don't ascribe to that. But you put savory as part of flavor, even though that crap is crap on your tongue.
It is. Look, I had to make some tough decisions in categorizing all of this. And it was, I mean, this was incredibly hard to try to categorize all of this. And that is, you zeroed in on the one category that's really not aroma driven. And it is, that's exactly right. You know, where we put savory on the wheel, we kind of lumped in basically the umami ingredients all together. Umami is not an aroma-driven response. It's a tongue-driven response, and it's kind of the one part of the flavor wheel, you know, in the matrix that is not fully aroma-driven.
Right, but you shade there also in sour, right? So when you say pungent, what you mean are these sulfurous
mustard.
Mustard hits,
exactly.
Right? So, but on the sour stuff. Like, to me, volatile sour is acetic.
Right.
Straight up, only acetic.
Mm-hmm.
The other acids, to me, are almost completely non-volatile. But I don't know. I think you see that as, like, kind of, like, also a bridge. At least in the book, it appears
And listen, every time we went through edits, something would come back, and I'd be like, separating herbaceous and menthol was brutal for me. Every time I was like, no, basil's menthol. No, basil's herbaceous. And we're, you know, back and forth because eventually I just had to, like, okay, this is where they're going to go, and we're leaving them there, and I'm not moving them anymore. That was one of the hardest ones. That was a very hard one for me, separating what was menthol, because you could make an argument for tarragon in there. You could make an argument for basil.
More than an argument for tarragon.
But you can make the same argument for them in herbaceous as well, because you've got so many of the strong green aromas. So,
But menthol also, I know they're different, but does that shade into kind of those eugenol-y kind of flavors to you? Like, to me, like...
Because then they start to straddle, like, the woody aromas, too.
That's what I'm saying. It's hard to make categories.
It was extraordinarily hard to make categories, and they're not perfect. I don't think you could ever, unless, you know, we unless we started separating by compound.
Yeah, you know, which is too much for people to absorb.
It's too much, right? It's hard. So we try to do our best, I mean, to just kind of find a good category to fit them in. And there are some that I really struggled with, and you, like, you nailed those right off of the bat.
Because they're tough. Look, tough is tough, the world around.
Yeah. It is what it is.
Yeah. It is what it is. I said that once, and someone, who was it, Ken Ingberg came back and was like, hey, we had another one for you. Do you remember, you said menthol, do you remember, like, 10, 11, 12 years ago when everyone was using freaking menthol crystals?
Yes.
Dang. Like, here's the one thing, like, it's like around the same time everyone was using Szechuan buttons, and I'm like, I'm that guy, and this was a big learning thing for me, because I am extremely sensitive, like, the menthol crystals, I'm like, they just blow my palate out for, like, a long time, but I'm sure that it doesn't have that effects on the chefs that are using it. So when you're, I think one of the interesting things about bringing new ingredients or Szechuan buttons, like, now my tongue tastes like I'm licking batteries and tinfoil for, like, you know, like 20 minutes.
It's very annoying. Like, I don't enjoy the experience of a Szechuan button.
I don't.
At all.
I have learned to enjoy higher quantities of Szechuan peppercorn at all.
Oh, I was going to ask if they were the same thing.
No, Szechuan buttons are these flowers that, like, if Szechuan peppercorns are like a jalapeno, Szechuan buttons are like a Carolina Reaper.
Yeah, you know what I mean? After you eat one, you feel like you just came from the dentist, and you're drooling out of the corner of your mouth, and you're slapping yourself on the cheek. Yeah. And nothing,
you can't taste a damn thing for 15, 20 minutes, you're shot in terms of, like, your discrimination. You know what I mean? Yeah. I'm sure if you're accustomed to it, that's not the case. The same way that, like, I can take a whole lot of capsicum heat and, you know, relatively quickly be in good tasting order again.
I'm not sure why you'd want to become accustomed to Szechuan
button. Yeah, but Szechuan peppercorn, I have become, you know, used to, like, through, like, people like Danny Bao. And
I've, say, thank
I've,
you,
yeah,
Danny.
Yeah, exactly. I've become accustomed to higher levels of it. But still, Szechuan buttons are a nightmare. But menthol, yeah, it was that thing. People were just, like, sprinkling menthol crystals all over everything. And I think that's because probably some people are more, you know, those of us that smoke cools are more, like, inured to the effect of menthol on the palate than talking to you, Alex Dupak. Like, I remember he used to like the menthol. But I think Sam Mason also used to, did he like the menthol? A lot of people like menthol.
Yeah.
But do you find that problem with new ingredients? Is that with old ingredients, cooks in general have a long track record of knowing what other people will think about them, right? And I learned this a lot when I was teaching at the French Culinary, and I'm sure you see teaching at ICE, is that when you're teaching large groups of people, or when you have a restaurant and you have a large group of people coming in, if you are willing to listen and take the feedback, you can learn that your palate isn't necessarily everyone's palate. But with new ingredients, it's hard because there's not a large enough, you know, as we say, N. There's not a large enough N to know how people are going to respond to it.
Yeah, and I think, you know, people, it's something new, it's something different, people get excited and they just want to, like, start throwing it everywhere. And I mean, I don't want my salad to taste like Icebreaker's gum. You know, that's just not cool in any way. But I think, yeah.
Unless you got a hot date. Oh! You know what I mean? It's like, yeah, that's the thing. It's like, you know, my mouth was freaking fresh after those menthol desserts. Maybe that's what it's about. But
I think, you know, it's something, you know, we've seen for a while now. It's like every new technique comes along, every new little trick, every new little ingredient, you know, there are, I mean, I thought foam is the best example. It's like, it's a great thing when you use it the right way, but it doesn't belong everywhere, and just because you can doesn't mean you should.
Yeah. Well, my favorite foam, whipped cream. God, I love whipped cream. I will put whipped cream on almost anything. I eat whipped cream off of spoons. I will just tuck into a bowl of whipped cream. I like whipped cream. I think, like, if God were to choose one food, I think whipped cream, maybe, because it's very ethereal. You know what I mean?
Bread is my favorite foam.
Ooh, bread is the
That's
bread
for
is
you,
good.
Michael Lascanis.
I love Michael. How's Michael doing?
He's good. He's good. Chocolating it up. Yeah.
Michael Scott's a good guy. Still ahead of pastry there at the...
Yeah, and, you know, we've got Bean de Bar chocolate facility now over at ICE, so that's kind of his land, and he's doing all kinds of cool things out of the chocolate lab.
Again, remember, don't stop at the bar. Go all the way to toilet. Bean to toilet. Farm to toilet. That's the thing. All right, now, my other larger bone to pick with you.
Oh.
So the way the flavor matrix starts out, for those of you that aren't, and we're going to get into it here, right? It starts out with your meeting, literally starts, like the first paragraph. It starts with your, well, I don't want to say meeting because it is a computer, Watson.
Interaction, right? With Chef Watson.
Interaction, yeah. With Watson, right. And
although, does it get mad if you don't call it Chef?
Nastasia's so strong. See, Nastasia's sitting there, you think she's shopping for shoes on Zappo, but then she comes out with it. Give me a little pen.
Well, you know, we know she's multitasking.
There's no such thing. People, when you say you're multitasking, that means you're doing everything poorly, right? Multitasking is French for I suck.
You know what, then? In that spirit, I think we should take a quick break before we finish out the show.
All right. We'll take a break. Come back more with cooking issues. This episode of Cooking Issues is brought to you by Bob's Red Mill, an employee-owned company that has been offering organic stone-ground products for decades.
We have a question from a listener about Bob's gluten-free egg replacer, which has four ingredients: potato starch, tapioca flour, baking soda, and psyllium husk fiber. Bill wants to know, what about this combination replicates the properties of eggs?
Now remember, anytime you're going to use an egg replacer, the question is, in what application are you using it? Eggs serve a lot of different functions. In this case, this Bob's Red Mill product is meant to be used in quick breads and other kind of baking applications. So what it's doing there is it's providing an air-holding kind of capacity, right? Because it gives kind of a thickening texture, and it's going to provide some leavening. So the baking soda is there to increase the leavening of the product. It's also going to make it slightly more basic. The psyllium is there as kind of this gluey thing that you get out of an egg. And then the starches are there to be fairly neutral. They're going to add some viscosity to the product, but also they're going to provide structure when it bakes out. And so potato starch in particular, and potato starch and tapioca starch, both have kind of very elastic texture. Well, tapioca especially is elastic when it's cooked, and potato starch swells a lot and soaks up a lot of water. So it's there to kind of provide those functions. Do you have a question about Bob's Red Mill ingredient? Tweet it to us at @heritage_radio.
If you want to try cooking with gluten-free egg replacer, go to bobsredmill.com and use the code COOKINGISSUES. That's one word, all caps, COOKINGISSUES, for 25% off your order.
And we're back! All right, Dave, you say we got some callers?
We do have a caller.
All right, so like we're going to take the callers, and then James, you and I are going to get back into flavor pairing theory because...
All right, jam it out.
We're going to have a big old fist fight over this. So, caller, you're on the air. Caller.
Hey.
All right, never mind.
All right.
Cool.
You said we had two, we have another, or we lose them both? Do we lose them both? All right, fist fight time.
Yeah, I think we lost them. All right, get into the fist fight.
All right. Sweet. So, here we go. So you start with meeting Watson, and then you say rather cavalierly that you got into this thing called flavor pairing theory. Now, we're not even going to get into the whole Hervé Tease thing because I don't have all day.
Oh my! I've had this fight with Hervé myself.
What's the point of having a fight with a guy who doesn't like the word food and says things like proteins don't exist? There's no point in fighting with. I'm not going to say on air that Hervé Tease is a huckster. I will leave it at
that. You just did.
By fight, I mean he gave me his opinion strongly, and I said, "Cool."
Nah, you know
nice
what?
Nice to meet you.
You got to beat that. Look. I've said this many times before. You're either a Tease person or a McGee person. I'm a McGee person, 100%, 100%.
Is that like Elvis and Beatles people?
No, because I like both Elvis and the Beatles.
So you can't like both of these people?
No.
Why not?
You can't like them both if you know a lot about either of them. That's what it is. You know what I mean? Like, Elvis and the Beatles are fundamentally unrelated. You know what I mean? Like maybe at a particular point in time, you were the kind of person who listened to Elvis, and those people didn't hang out with Beatles people. But there's nothing inherently that says you can't listen to Bossa Nova Baby, which, by the way, was written by Ed Wood's wife, ex-wife, before, well, I think they're all dead now. Great song.
Veering off topic.
Or, you know,
time is limited.
Love Me Do. Yeah. Anyway, my point being is that I think there's a more fundamental difference between Tease's approach to the world and Harold McGee's approach to the world. All right, so flavor pairing theory, I will say it simply and roughly, and then you can tell me why I'm being over simplistic and whatnot, but that in some way, like goes with like, and by studying the compounds that are in X, Y, or Z food, you can learn other things that go with it that have similar compounds. This was also been, there are other things that are related to flavor pairing theory that have to do with the rise of big data over the past 15 years or so, where people have done lots of studies on the similarities and or differences of what they consider to be the important compounds in recipes. All of the studies I have seen like that on, for instance, in massive quotes, cross-cultural studies of recipes based on data mining, I think are by and large, no offense to them, garbage. Because I think that if you read the underlying data sets that they use, they're like, well, we looked up Asia for white people. And then we, you know what I mean? And like they don't go to the fundamental issue of how cuisines arise, which is we have these ingredients and we've lived with them for 1,000 years and here's what we've come up with over, and then this has been injected, this injected. So, but that's that section of what I think is like the larger complex of points of which flavor, you know, flavor pairing theory is a part, I don't think is as germane to you, to what you're writing about. So in other words, I don't think you care so much in here whether or not the average Western, if there is even a word Western, if that even makes sense, because it doesn't, like butter, you know, pairing of butter and flour and, you know, which they, you know, point out whether that, whether those aroma compounds go together, I don't think is part of the main thesis of your book. I think it goes more to this thing, which, you know, I look up like Bernard Lahousse or these other folks who are looking, much as you did, on the compounds that are similar and saying, let's look at new pairings that result from these similarities in compounds. And I would say the most famous early example is kind of the, what is it,
chocolate, white chocolate and caviar.
Yeah. Is that any good? Have you ever tasted it?
I have. It actually is. It actually is. But I think the white chocolate and caviar, more than anything, it's the salty sweet.
Right.
You know, that I think that's like
the big, white chocolate pretty neutral other than the vanilla, right?
I mean, that was the thing, you know, that we got into when we with Liscano when we first started talking about it. I mean, you know, it's cocoa butter, sugar, and sugar. You know, yeah, essentially
and vanilla.
Right. So really you're looking at the vanilla pairing with caviar and, you know, vanilla. Vanilla's got a lot going on there and pairs with a lot of things because it is, you know, one of those complex, even though it doesn't have, you know, the high number of compounds. In fact, it's kind of surprisingly low when you look at coffee that's got, you know, over 800 compounds that make up the aroma of coffee, only about 200 in vanilla. But I think it's something we would absolutely call complex, even so, you know, to your point earlier that, you know, you can have something be very complex, even though it doesn't have this, you know, massive number of compounds in it. So to your point about flavor pairing theory and where you're going, I think, you know, there was a big study about 4 or 5 years ago that I think exactly the one you're talking about where they looked at shared compounds in, quote, Western, traditional Western recipes versus traditional Eastern recipes.
I think that's garbage science.
Yeah. I think the point of it is they found plenty of very popular recipes or dishes that have very few shared compounds in them.
Right.
So kind of against what we're saying here in the flavor metrics. And then in, you know, again, the Western idea, we found a much higher incidence of the shared flavor compounds. What it really to me comes down to more is the like and like, you know, things that are similar go well together. And one really interesting thing I found that was just like too much to get into and a little too early in it, but with some of the early researchers in the Chef Watson project, we've been discussing it lately. And a lot of flavor data, you know, a lot of the flavor compounds are derived from environment. So it kind of takes us a little back to that, you know, what grows together goes together kind of thing.
Which I also don't believe, but go ahead.
We gotta wrap up then.
Wait,
what?
Yeah.
What?
It's time.
Wait, okay, go ahead.
Well, I think
final thoughts.
And that's, you know, that's just a matter of.
We just got into it, Dave. All right,
that's okay. I can skip.
Go.
You know, that's just a matter of like, hey, here's, you know, these are the ingredients we have, so our taste became suited to them.
There you go.
This is all we had to
ding,
cook
ding,
with.
Ding, ding, ding.
I think one of my favorite data points in it is that chemically, olive oil is better suited for apples than butter is. So take that and make your apple pie. with olive oil instead of butter.
Have you tried it?
Yeah.
How is it? Hard to make a decent crust out of olive oil.
It is hard to make it. But we did a sous vide poached apple in olive oil. We did, you know, a little vacuum infusion with olive oil and then poached apples sous vide in olive oil, and they are freaking awesome.
First of all, what apple are you taking as your prime apple?
That was a...
I mean, in terms of the Golden compounds. Delicious. Okay, Golden Delicious. So that's that's the apple of...
Which is a little green. It's got more of the green aroma.
So are you choosing a greener olive oil or a more butter olive oil?
Yeah, I guess it's probably a greener olive oil. See, that's something, you know, so, I mean, and that's the thing we had to do in the book is kind of look at generalities, because there could be an entire book of different apple matrices, you know, I mean, when you getting into the, you know, different varieties and different things going on.
There are, like, yeah, apples fall into camps, but those camps are very different from each other.
Yeah,
you know what I mean? In terms of aroma, and then the interplay of what their aroma is with their underlying sugar acid base,
yep.
I think is like super important. Anyway, so we could go on forever, but I'll say this. Here's what I think. I think that you should check out the book and you should look at it. And while I do not ascribe to the fact that like always goes with like, I think there's a lot of places in here where you will see things that you have put together before, and you will see the similarity once you see them on the wheel. And I also think that, like, the Hervé Tisse model of just taking a bunch of things and randomly combining them based on some sort of, like, metric, I don't think you ascribe to this, because I think that's garbage work.
And that's what that's his counter to flavor pairing there. He's like, I could just taste a bunch of stuff together and figure it out eventually, too. I'm like,
He's wrong.
A little more systematic. I think it's a great spot for people to go, you know, inspiration. You want to get some new ideas. You want to try out something different. You know, this can point you in some good directions. Look, exactly. Like it or don't, just buy it.
Yeah, just buy it.
Then you don't have to like it.
But I think that's what the thing is. I think that anytime someone becomes dogmatic is when they run into problems. And you have a section here where you're saying things that are complementary, right, versus things that are opposing.
Or balancing.
And to put it, you always want to balance. I mean, that's why I used to love going to JG so much, because he was the French, the high-end French restaurant that knew how to balance their stuff with acid better.
That's a great place to leave it.
Hold on, but don't...
No, but really.
The ads after.
But what I'm saying is I think as a source of inspiration and learning, I think we can agree, right, that is the most interesting thing, is it gives you new places to look for pairings that you wouldn't necessarily have looked for. Not necessarily. Would you agree that it's not necessarily true that always like goes with like?
Absolutely.
If two things have a poop aroma in them and you put them together, it's that's just double like poop.
Double poop.
Nobody wants double poop.
Absolutely. Nobody wants double poop.
All right. Thanks for coming on.
All right. Thank
Cooking
you.
Cooking issues.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.